fiat money is this system that is programmatically conditioned to debase, and Bitcoin is this alternate system that is systematically programmed to be based. You matter. You as a person matter. Your voice matters. What you want to pursue matters. And you need to financially take care of yourself so that your voice can be heard. Like, you know, your ability to participate in this future cannot decrease because the money is decreasing.
Hello, my friends. Thank you so much for coming back to another episode of the podcast. As I was telling my guest today, Ella Huff, I'm in a public location, so I'm going to be in my best ASMR, deep, low voice today, introducing everything. And this is such good timing because I didn't even really think of this when I first reached out to you a while ago, but I had this random idea at the end of my usual Christmas vacation where I come back home for the holidays back in the Pacific Northwest, that I would, why not go back and live by my school that I went to, the University of Washington in Seattle. And so I'm actually here right now. I'm not sure if you can see the background. There's big W's everywhere. But then it occurred to me, oh, I'm talking to Ella. She's in school right now. She's going to Cornell, and she's all about Bitcoin for the university. So Ella Huff, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to talk about this.
No, thank you, Ben. I've been looking forward to it.
So why don't we start off with your backstory? I know that it has some interesting wrinkles, and you're very young, obviously, and you've gotten into this quite early, and it's been a crazy ride for you, I'm sure. So could you give us a bit of a background on how Bitcoin came into your life and where you're at right now in terms of all these cool projects you're working on, which includes, sorry, I should have mentioned this, founder of the Cornell Bitcoin Club, co-founder of the Bitcoin Students Network, and project lead at Generation Bitcoin. All super cool things trying to help young people get more into Bitcoin. Give us the origin story for how you got here.
Yes, I'd be happy to. And you kind of hit the nail on the head saying that it's a little bit of a wrinkle, different pieces coming in. I have this quote that I really like. It's always be collecting dots, always be connecting dots. And really only it's now kind of 4 years later that I can even figure out how did I get into this space. But it really all started when I was in high school. Oh, that was the first moment when I ever really heard the word Bitcoin. My school that I went to had this certificate program called the Technology Innovation and Entrepreneurship Program. And you, at the end of your time at the school, you do a capstone project. And the idea is you have one person from each of the strands. And so I chose innovation. And one of the courses that fulfills that was called blockchain technology. So that was the first time I ever really heard of Bitcoin, but it was all kind of in the preface of distributed ledger technology, and it totally went over my head. I was really interested in AI and ethics in AI. I had just come back from what was supposed to be a year abroad in Beijing, and we can chat about that later, but my headspace was all there. And then I started my freshman year of college. And I was supposed to actually go back to China after COVID, but we could never get our visas. And so I spent the year at home. And during that year, my mom and I kind of fell down the rabbit hole together, just listening to podcasts, reading, kind of just absorbing. I don't even think I had a Twitter yet. And then the summer came, and my mom and I went to the Oslo Freedom Forum, put on by the Human Rights Foundation in Norway. And it was on the plane ride home when I kind of say I really started, I truly discovered Bitcoin, just completely fell down the rabbit hole. And it was at that time as well that I was transferring to Cornell. And that really, I think, was the true beginning of my just study, kind of put all my time and energy that I could into the space. So that was kind of the real tipping point. But some other, I think, things that primed me when I was, I think I must have been like a sophomore in high school or maybe even earlier, my parents sat me down and we made a spreadsheet of what I was going to need to study in college to basically figure out how to pay all my bills. Like what was the highest paying major I could get or what would this look like? So that was one. And then another, my freshman year of college, that time I was home, I took this class on creativity where they just said, you know, study any creator you want and you're going to do a semester long project. And I chose Kathy Wood. And so I was just hearing a lot of the messaging about disruptive innovation and creative destruction and trying to think about what's next. So I would say it maybe I can only gather this looking back, but there were lots of different touch points that ultimately led me here.
Something I really want to bookmark is how you talked about that need for needing to ask as you go into school, what mm-hmm. makes the most money?
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. just the fact that this is even I would say probably the highest question for most people is really yeah. sad, because people aren't asking, what do I love to do? What am I good at? Mm-hmm. What does the world need? No, it's like, what makes the most money? Because I need to be able to survive in this inflation ravaged environment that is everywhere. So
yeah.
that's crazy. We'll get into that a little bit later, I'm sure, as we get right. deeper into the weeds of this stuff. But, very cool story. And I hope you don't mind me asking, how old are you by chance?
I'm 21.
21. So
yeah.
Okay. So you were right.
I think I was 17 when I
first. So is that
first.
Like right in the middle of Gen Z? Something like that, right?
Yeah, so Gen Z, I think the numbers differ a little, but generally it's 1997 to 2013. So I was born in 2003. So I'm kind of on, I would say, the earlier side of it. Right now, I think the ages are like 13 to 27 that we're at.
Cool. Yeah, so this is just a topic I just feel like we can't talk enough about, is how do we get yeah. this generation more interested in? I talked to someone who I know you're close with, Gen Z for BTC, super cool guy.
Yes.
And we went into it a lot. And I think that you have a very different perspective on this. So I'm excited to dive into that. But what's your take on, like, what do people think about Bitcoin? Are they even thinking about it on average? I'm assuming, you know, I'm here on a college campus right now. And I feel like if I ask most people about Bitcoin, sadly, I don't think it would be that much different than what my very first touch point was back when I was here. I graduated in 2017, and when I heard about it, I was like, oh, that's a crypto thing. I'm not really that into money. I'm not fascinated by economics or whatever. So I just kind of just fell off my back. And I feel like most people are the same way. Do you see the same, or are you more optimistic for that demographic?
Well, I think I always try to have a very optimistic take on things, but I think it's exactly what you said. Most people don't think about what is money. Or, you know, they might think about money, but not truly what it is. And what I've found being on just a college campus, when I first got here my sophomore year, so this was 2022, I wanted to start a Bitcoin club. And I went to activities and said, hey, I want to start this club. And they're like, okay, but you're going to need 10 people. And we really prefer you just join a club that already exists. And I said that might be similar in nature. And I said, okay, well, I don't know 10 people yet. And sure, let me join the blockchain club. I think this could be a good way to kind of meet new people, and I'll find some, you know,
find a
people
potential
that are
toxic Maxis hiding in the in the grass in there.
Yeah, I was like, I'll find some Bitcoiners in there. Ultimately, fast forward, I was the only true Bitcoiner in the club out of about, you know, 60 something. And then obviously now I've started the Bitcoin club last January. And what I see a lot, kind of just in school, there's a couple different distinctions that might change the conversation. One, if you're kind of an CS econ person, you might just be opposed to Bitcoin if you're more in the econ department. If it's more of a CS, you're just all about what's the technology? How can I kind of really use skills I've learned in class? And so I think people are generally more attracted to blockchain and Web3 and the buzzwords and what that entails. But then the third group, which I think is often the largest, is people that, you know, aren't a CS econ major, especially if they're not from the US, way more open to learning about Bitcoin, or just this idea of how can I just build some sound footing for myself? How am I going to take care of myself? And so I think generally when I talk to my peers, people about Bitcoin, and I'm still working on the messaging, I think you learn a lot. but it's really not about the Bitcoin. And I think your show especially touches on this as well. It's like, how do I live just a sound life? How can I just be sound in my choices and my decisions and protect my agency and my ability to think for myself? And that's what Bitcoin gives you. And who doesn't, you know, want to not, as Seyfedin says, you know, work twice to earn my wealth? You know, you're here at school because you have some why that you want to pursue, some passion, something that gives you joy. And so that's what I more so try to talk to people and frame for them. Just try to ignore what you've heard in the media or seen, and, you know, let's just get to the root of it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's cool that it was last January that you started. So it's been almost exactly a year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you must have found 10 people. So to tell me the story on how it actually got started and what the state of it now is, starting from that place where you're literally the only Bitcoiner in a big crypto group.
Yeah, so now there was 124 members kind of on our mailing list in December. So at the end of its second semester. And well, we can chat about this too, with why did we start the Bitcoin Students Network, which the Cornell Club is just a node of. But really, there's way more people that are interested in Bitcoin that want to talk about it. You just have to create the space for it to happen. And so when I get to talk to students all over the world, we have students across like 69 countries at this point. And, you know, we get on a call and they're like, okay, you know, maybe I don't have a lot of time, or I'm the only one that's interested in Bitcoin. And I just say, look, what success is you just get a group of people together and you have dinner, or you go for a walk, or you grab a coffee and you have a conversation about Bitcoin. Or maybe that leads you down a totally different tangent, but that's the goal here. And so that's what we've done the past two semesters. Every week we would just meet once a week, maybe sometimes more if there was, like, we screen Dirty Coin. We're going to screen God Bless Bitcoin this semester. So if there's some activity like that. But really, we just come and frame it from, let's look at Bitcoin as a tool that you can use in your life. And it doesn't need to become your main interest, but how can it kind of supplement what else you're interested in? And so, yeah, now we've surpassed 100. And it's really amazing, which is, if you create the space, what can happen?
That's so great. Congratulations on all that success. That's super cool. Is there any guess on, like, how many people total across the whole network, or is that too big to even predict?
No, I know it. I was just in the spreadsheet. It's like in the 1700s, except for that includes people in industry. I would say the number of students is closer to like 1500. And then people that are actually working on building clubs, that one's closer to like the 100 range.
That's extremely cool. That's such a cool success story. I'm sure there's just so much left to run. You're leaving a legacy right here behind you, which is amazing. One of the things that is the first question that comes to my head, as you mentioned earlier, the economics department seems like they aren't a big fan of this, probably. I don't know if they, like, publicly say, like, oh, these Bitcoiners they're going against our fiat teaching, our Keynesianism. We need these central banks to smooth out the boom and bust cycles and all the things that they say. And, you know, I wasn't even thinking about this stuff enough to remember if that's exactly what I was taught when I took those classes myself, which I did. I took Econ 101 just to get the credits. But, you know, I can pretty much guess that everyone I've talked to that went through an economics or finance degree, that's exactly what they teach. So have you seen any friction between these clubs that are basically saying all these classes you guys are taking are nonsense?
So yes, I did a business minor, and I already had a macro credit, but I did have to take micro, and Paul Krugman wrote that textbook. And I would say it's a little bit of a mixed bag in the econ department. For instance, there's one professor who's very vocal about perhaps not a big fan of Bitcoin. There's another professor, though, who has joined my thesis committee, who is just a, you know, complete intellectual, just like, let's have an academic discussion about this. Let's think about it. You know, just a very, I think, everything you'd want. So it's not kind of a one size fits all. And then I would say in the club itself, there's So there's no overlap really with the blockchain club. There might be one or two people that are in both. And the major composition in the club, there's a lot of like bio, law, government. It's not super econ heavy. Information science is a major we have here. What I really like about that is we're trying to just get a broad agreement across all of campus. Everyone needs to know about it. And so that's another thing, how it's structured. A lot of clubs on campus can be kind of exclusive, like only undergrad, only grad. But how the club is set up here and how I kind of put it in the model for the other clubs is, no, just be open to everyone. So then you get really cool discussions that happen as well.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that we mentioned a couple of times here, which I think is so crucial. And you outline it well, which is, Bitcoin doesn't have to be your main focus, and it shouldn't be for most people. There are a few crazy weirdos like us who just listen to Bitcoin podcasts every day and, you know, start podcasts about Bitcoin, and they're just like obsessed with this thing because we see that it's a tool that everyone will be able to use. Because I'm a total generalist. I'm not sure about you, but I love, you know, having a little bit of knowledge in a lot of different things, and I just enough to know that every single one of these different occupations can benefit from understanding Bitcoin. Because when people can just save their money in a sound currency that's not debased, it's going to help them be able to pursue their craft that they actually excel in and they love. So, like, could you elaborate on that a little bit? Would you agree with me there? I'm sure you do.
Oh, 1,000%. And that's why I think it's just so important. It's important for everyone to know, but I think it's uniquely and especially important for younger generations to know. You know, Bitcoin was born in Gen Z. If you think about this Gen Z demographic, and I know there's even younger ones now, but they're kind of at the age when they're thinking about, what am I going to study in college? Maybe I'm in college. Okay, what internships am I going to get? Basically, you're just at a ground where you don't have a lot of capital in an old system. You can really learn it right for the first time. Often money is not taught in schools. Financial education is not taught in schools. And so they're kind of at the beginning of building their nest egg. It's not already established. There's not as much of maybe like a sunk cost fallacy at play here. And so I think especially where you are just at the beginning, you're at the starting line. Like I always learned growing up, college was not the end. It was the beginning. You have so much, the ability for so much choice and agency over what you want to do, what craft, as you mentioned, you really want to hone and pursue. And so, you know, I just think I kind of have this analogy, which some Austrian economics have said, maybe it's not the greatest analogy, but thinking about Bitcoin as almost like economic oxygen, kind of breathing life back into younger generations' future. I wrote a report earlier this summer trying to just understand the state of Gen Z and how we might market Bitcoin to Gen Z. And so I was reading a lot of different reports from basically anyone that I could find. So a lot of EY, Deloitte, Coinbase had some. And the overwhelming takeaway is Gen Z is not hopeful about the future. Financial concerns are kind of the top concern. They don't want to follow a traditional path. They really want to choose their own path. And so just for many reasons, Bitcoin and Gen Z are very well aligned. We just have to reach them in the messaging.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's so important, that this is a tool for hope, you know, and this is like we always pound this mantra as Bitcoiners that Bitcoin creates hope in people. And it sounds crazy for people who haven't really studied it. It sounds like we're going too far with this thing, but it really does just touch everything. So how do you specifically give that elevator pitch when you're saying this gives my generation hope, this gives us hope, when you're talking to your brothers and sisters in your age group? How do you pass that along to them to give them the first nibble of the orange peel and how this will actually make their future better, no matter what they're interested in?
It's a really good question. And I think also my answer changes a little bit depending on what I know about the person, because there's just no, your perspective differs a lot depending if you're from the US or you're from outside the US or you're Like I have one friend whose family is from Russia, one whose family is from Iran, and you can just kind of frame the messaging in a way that might just resonate with them faster. So a lot of sharing Bitcoin with people is listening and trying to figure out what they're concerned about, what they're thinking about, where their head is at. But generally, my, I guess, thesis from really early on when I first made my Twitter X was that the 21 million Bitcoin were tools for the 21st century in a lot of different ways. That's why my handle is what it is. But at the root of it also, just kind of very simply saying, fiat money is this system that is programmatically conditioned to debase, and Bitcoin is this alternate system that is systematically programmed to be based. You matter. You as a person matter. Your voice matters. What you want to pursue matters. And you need to financially take care of yourself so that your voice can be heard. Like, you know, your ability to participate in this future cannot decrease because the money is decreasing. So yeah, something in that regard, just how it's really all about them and not what, you know, you know, this is just the right thing to do or make some huge moral case, like really speak to them as that person.
Yeah, definitely. I from my sales learning that I did over the years, that is what you have to do. You have to figure out what their exact pain point is and not focus on anything else. Just figure out what they're interested in. And this topic of marketing to a generation is such a big, broad topic. And it's funny. So I talked to Gen Z for BTC, our mutual friends, and we got into how specifically boys love video games. Every boy loves video games, even, you know, college kids. Like, I remember when I was living in a fraternity, me and my roommate would be playing Mortal Kombat every single day. It's like, that just, it just resonates with the young male brain. And I know this isn't a niche for you so much talking about the different gender stuff. You're talking to the whole generation, but is there an equivalent to the video game side for girls? Because for video games, it's, you can clearly see there's like a digital currency component there. Everyone who's played video games knows, oh, I used to the Call of Duty credits or the Fortnite credits. So this is just a new currency on the internet. It's kind of a smooth bridge. Is there a similar one that you see for women that can also work?
Yeah, honestly, there probably is. I haven't ever given it terribly much thought. I think, my hook, what I took away from the Oslo Freedom Forum when I was there was, and maybe this is the analogy that could exist, this idea that Bitcoin was this tool, this thing that 365 days a year, 24/7 looked out for, you know, every individual. You know, it was this thing that was able to really focus on the individual and protect that individual. And so I would say the human rights piece really resonated with me. And in many places in the world, women can't own wealth, own property. And so it allows that ability. Maybe it, for women, it stereotypically, it's this idea of kind of being protecting, nurturing. But I honestly, when I talk to, you know, my friends that are girls versus friends that are guys, there, I don't use a different messaging. It's just everyone needs this. But perhaps there is that someone has thought of that as well. Another analogy, though, that I think is definitely in the West holds the idea of like a piggy bank. And when you're little, you have this idea of custodying your wealth, owning your wealth. But then for some reason, I did this myself when I was maybe 14, 15, I had my first job and I wanted to go open a bank account and get like a debit card or just kind of put my money in the bank. I was so excited by it. I was like, wow, I'm an adult like this. I feel so, you know, I'm really growing up. And like, why do we have this idea that it's just so exciting to turn all our money away and our wealth away? And so when people say, oh, you know, I could never self-custody my Bitcoin. And I can get their circumstances where it's not for everyone, but we've done it when we're, you know, 4, 5, 6, and you've done it before. So there's another analogy.
We do all have this innate feeling that saving something up over time, seeing it grow, is fulfilling. And it's funny you mentioned that, like the piggy bank thing. I still remember this big Ziploc bag that I saved all my allowances and all of my chore money and things. I must have been, you know, 10 years old or even younger, just like really working hard to build up this big bag, I could go take it to the bank and have my savings account there. And the problem is, though, that this, the traditional savings in a bank, we now know, is not the way to go, because debasement. And you talked about how people don't like big words. That means it goes down. So you don't want, you don't want to hold your money in something that's programmed to go down. So I think that a big part of this is the parenting aspect and the families that are bringing up these kids in the next generation. So you had an amazing, you know, family story. Your mother is wonderful. I've listened to her in Twitter spaces. I haven't gotten to talk to her in person before, but she's an awesome Bitcoiner as well. So the fact that the two of you got to do this together is just so beautiful. What part do you think that the parents out there who may be either, or maybe the planning people who just plan to become parents and have their own kids, what do they need to understand to pass down this information so kids can start being raised with this understanding that you simply save in Bitcoin? You don't hold cash in a Ziploc bag like I do.
Yes, I think I would preface with my mom gave a really good talk at BitBlock Boom kind of on this topic. And then we also did an episode with Jimmy Song earlier this year. So I would say she's the true person with wisdom on this topic. But as a child in the parent-child relationship, I would say that, you know, talk to your kids about it a lot of times, at least talking to other friends, their parents never talked to them about money or really brought them into that conversation from a young age. And I think it is important to really talk to your children and value them as much of an equal as you can. So that's hugely helpful. And then also, I think my parents just raised me with, you know, we trust you, we believe in you, we think you make good decisions, you know, you can figure this out, we're here to help you. But also they said, you know, you graduate college, you're on your own, you know, we're getting you this far and then it's up to you. And so I was mentioning the spreadsheet earlier and I had made the comment, I wanted to be a history major. It's like, I really like history. I want to be a history major. And my mom was like, no, you're not going to be a history major. Maybe she said it a little bit nicer, not as blunt than that. But she's very practical. Both my parents are. We got home and then we're like, okay, you know, how much does a history major on average make? Jot that number down. Okay, you know, Ella, where do you want to live? Do you want to own a car? Do you, you know, where do you want to shop for your groceries? Just, we went like very nitty gritty into all of the different things. Really quickly, the number was in the negative. It was just not going to work. And so then that's why we thought, okay, you know, what do I need a major in? What does it really, it's expensive to just go out and breathe and live. How is this going to work? And it's really important to have that conversation with your kids early on, so that then when they're in, if they're in the traditional schooling, when they're in, you know, middle school or high school, they can think about, why do I want to get good grades? Why do I want to care about this? Why do I want to apply myself? So that then you can set yourself up to have the option to get into a good school, to get into a good program. You can't just make it work overnight.
I love that you use history as your example of something that isn't known to be a high paying focus in school, because that's kind of one of the ones, like philosophy would be another one, history and philosophy. Oh, you know, you're not gonna be able to do anything with that. You can't make any money with that. Mm-hmm. And when you really just look at that objectively, how sad is that? Those are two mm-hmm. extremely important things. Those yeah. should be crucial to our species, you know, understanding our past so we can learn from it and build a better future. And philosophy has been around forever. Mm-hmm. But these are the things you look at. Oh, you can't make money with that. So, yeah, not worth your time. So I'm just so excited for the new paradigm where, and we keep bringing this back, I really think it's worth just drilling in, is that I think, you know, I will even say this. I would say if I was talking to a high schooler that was going into school, I'm almost more optimistic about these focuses now than I was, you know, a few years ago, because I understand, like, especially with Noster coming out, where anyone mm-hmm. can share anything just out on a social media platform space and just get paid for it. And anyone can start a podcast now. Anyone can, like, monetize their interests in mm-hmm. all these different ways. I'm actually really bullish on that. I think that we don't need to look too far into the future to see a time where these things that are so innate to humanity, like philosophy and history, they become profitable again for people, because like people like me that just like learning about all sorts of weird, interesting stuff. I love diving down these rabbit holes about ancient history. Like, oh, what about Tartaria? What about, you know, were there giants? Were there all these different things, like was stuff hidden from us in the new textbooks, which I think is a fascinating thing to learn about. And when I see people share this stuff on a place like Noster, I zap it. I send them money. Like, I want to pay people to go down this stuff. So are you equally bullish on just... and maybe we could get into Noster as well, because I know you're on there too. But where's your bullishness level on like how soon we are to people being able to like actually be able to financialize these things that they're interested in?
Yeah, I mean, so I saw someone tweet about this recently. This summer I was at Galaxy and they put out a report, I think it was last year, basically talking about the great wealth transfer. And they put, I think it was like 2 years ago, but I saw a couple weeks ago, someone put out a similar tweet about how much wealth is going to be coming into younger generations. And Fidelity also put out a report, I think it was last spring, basically looking at the perceptions of different age groups towards digital assets, Bitcoin in particular. And it's like above, it's like 63% of, I think 27 and younger have a favorable view on Bitcoin. And so I think that's really bullish on, you know, how do younger generations, how will they embrace Bitcoin and really be able to achieve this freedom and this ability to think and really be, really choose where they spend their time. We did do a panel on Noster for the club this year, and I use Primal a lot to onboard people just even before like a Lightning wallet or something, because it's just easier, the ability to instantly be able to zap someone and just see it, Bitcoin working and what that looks like. But it's going to take a lot. I don't know, it might take like some big celebrity to get on there to have people come and look. I'm in this class, Surveillance and Privacy, this semester, and it was the first day of class yesterday, so it was the first day of this one. And talking about that, they brought up the court case with TikTok being banned in the Supreme Court and all of that. No one knew what Noster was. And so I think it's just going to take time. You have to, just as I did, you know, I had many touch points to be able to recognize Bitcoin and to want to learn more and put my attention there. But I think I had a huge privilege to be able to do that, to spend the time to think about that and figure it out. And so, you know, I think it's inevitable, but you just have to kind of help people along and give them enough touch points. But I think that where we're going, all the touch points are going to be there.
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a smooth transition for people. And this is why Noster has become such a pillar for my podcast, even more so sometimes in Bitcoin, because it bridges you into Bitcoin. It's a perfect first place to start using Bitcoin and understand how powerful the Lightning Network is. The fact that you can post anything you want and just get paid for it without any hassle on the back end. You don't have to wait for Elon to pay you on Twitter or, you know, TikTok payments, all these centralized silos that are just, you know, other institutions that have their own agendas and own algorithms to push those agendas. That's all gone now. You can post whatever you want and get paid for it. And that is profound. It's so interesting to me. I can't wait to see that continue to proliferate. And I think that Gen Z is especially primed for this, even more than Bitcoin, because all you're doing is downloading an app. You're just getting social media. You don't even have to worry about the exchanges and the cold storage and all that. You're just, you know, finding a new place to post pictures of whatever. And I'm super, super interested in seeing how this happens, because I think that once some spark really starts that fire for the younger generation, it's going to take off in a big way. Because like you said as well, it's mostly influencer driven right now. We sort of see these sporadic events that give big boosts of flames on the adoption for Noster. Like last year, there were a few big ones, just like global events, like the Telegram Brazil. CEO getting taken Telegram. To Brazil, X-Ban, and just in otherwise, just when like big people on Twitter or TikTok just make a big post that goes viral on the platform and says, I'm going over here, you see a big spurt of new people. So it's kind of spurty right now. It's still like coming in spurts depending on certain factors and just random events. But what do you think is, what's going to cause that really to start to domino effect to where we don't need those spurts anymore? It just starts really growing naturally. Do you think that that's going to happen soon here, maybe this year or next? Or, I mean, am I being too crazy thinking this is like about to happen? It just seems like it's so close.
Yeah. So I will also say I never had social media before Twitter. I've never had Instagram, never had Facebook, Snapchat, any of that. So I think anything on the social media sides, I'm probably not the expert on that. But I think most often you make a change when you feel pain and you need to figure out where it is, especially with something like a social network. Are your friends there? Is your network there? I don't think it's really going to take off unless people can connect with their other friends there. But to be more specific, so we are doing a study in the Brooks Tech Policy Institute here at Cornell. And it's the Reynolds Foundation and the Human Rights Foundation are our partners in it, providing the funding. But really, it's looking at Bitcoin adoption and financial freedom across 25 different countries around the world. It has two parts to it. So there is a survey part that's kind of like our quantitative data. And then the second part is a qualitative data piece, like stories. And so we have like 15 different sections on the survey, which is going out to like between 1,000 to 2,000 per country. And it's really getting at, you know, what are, like, why are people adopting, what behaviors within a demographic, what perceptions, what attitudes are people or are they not adopting Bitcoin to aid in financial freedom or some other aspect. And we have 10 people from the Bitcoin Club that are helping in the second part of it, which is kind of the interview story side. And we'll have all that data back by the end of next year, May 2026. But I think we'll learn a lot from that, about why people are not adopting Bitcoin, and perhaps those insights can go over to Noster as well. Because there's been the Chainalysis for like the past 5-6 years, a kind of global crypto adoption index, but there has not been anything looking at just Bitcoin. And so that's what this study is doing. And then I'll also kind of add, I have been doing a lot of just kind of, I guess literature review is the fancy name for it, trying to just see what is out there in academia on Bitcoin. And I came across this article that was really interesting, basically trying to propose Noster as a solution, but not mentioning it anywhere. I can send it to you later. It was really interesting to read. It's just not known yet. And I feel very grateful that, you know, we get to know about it. Like I would not know about Noster if it were not for Bitcoin. But I think if you look at the communities that are predominantly on it right now, it's because they recognized some problem and it was a solution for them.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just continue ticking upward, I think. And I'm with you. If I wasn't in Bitcoin, I mean, it's still mostly Bitcoiners, I would say. I'm not sure what the percentage is. It's been diversifying a bit in the last year, which is great. But it's still a bunch of nerdy folks mostly that are in there, which comes with its own perks. You get to get smart pretty quick if you go in there. You're going to get a lot of signal from people who've been in the game for a while. But I'm glad you brought up the international component, looking at all these different countries, because one of the quotes I pulled from you from one of the other podcasts of yours I listened to just getting ready for this was, Bitcoin is a language all 8 billion people can speak. So could you elaborate on that a little bit? How do you view Bitcoin as this language and how it brings people together in this way?
Yeah, so this is actually what I'm writing my thesis about, if it's okay, I won't go too much into it right now, but it's kind of game theory meets linguistics, I would say, are the two main topic areas of it. But really, just this idea, and it actually something that primed me, I think, to get to this further. I wrote this article, I think it was like Bitcoin, I can't sleep thoughts. Like I was just thinking about it when I was trying to fall asleep. And it was inspired by a talk that Dhruv Bansal, who co-founded Unchained, gave. And it had to do with AI and how are we going to have like ethical AI. And I sort of had this idea that Bitcoin can almost, sorry, I'm trying to not jump around too much, embed ethics in a way that language embodies a little bit, but more so when you transact with Bitcoin, when you're exchanging this information and this value, even if you can't speak the same language as that person, you're still saying, you know, I value you. I value, you know, these certain rights. I see you. I hear you. So another piece also in the white paper, Bitcoin is described as this communications channel. You know, how are we moving this information, this value, without a trusted intermediary across this communications channel? So I've just been going a lot into that component, kind of looking at speech and writing and how that relates to kind of store of value, medium of exchange, this idea of a language game, inspired from this professor that I took a couple classes with. So it's kind of like the language game and the wealth game. Those are the two components of it, with lots of sub arguments wrapped up in it.
We have to bring up AI, because you mentioned that, and I don't think I've ever even talked about this once out of, what is it, almost 100 episodes now. I think we should talk about this because this was originally a big focus for you. Maybe still is. Are you still really like enthralled by that?
Honestly, it's taken a bit of a, it's on the back burner a bit now. So how it all started when I my senior year of high school, as a part of this entrepreneurship, innovation, technology certificate thing, we did this, it was called intermission, like an internship over the winter break. And it was supposed to be 2 or 3 weeks. And I did mine with IBM in Canada. And then I ended up staying for 2 years. But AI was obviously just a big part of that, of IBM. And so I kind of I took like an edX course on AI and just got really interested in it and started like joining whatever calls I could. And when I was in China, when I landed, I didn't know any part of Mandarin at all. Zero Chinese knowledge, didn't even know hello. But I had an amazing host family that really only spoke Chinese and incredible teachers at the school we went to. And one day our teacher wrote a character up on the board. And it was this character describing one of the tenets of Confucianism. And I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but it's Xiaoxuan. And so it's X-I-A-O. That's the first character, Xiao. It describes the relationship between a parent and a child. And the character visually shows this parent-child relationship where the child supports the parent when they're elderly and how the parent will support the child in their youth. And so I had this kind of Chinese, this AI in my head, and I was like, huh, wouldn't it be cool if you could code ethics into AI, into a computer language? So that's kind of like one of the first touch points of this Bitcoin as a language idea. And ultimately, I don't think you actually can, but that's where I was going with that.
Yeah, and I can imagine that when you just realize that these systems are always going to have some sort of bias, it seems like it's a hard battle to win. I know there's all sorts of different AI platforms out there, and it's always sort of floating around what is the latest best one that people think is the most accurate. And usually it just tends to be the one that is the most just truth telling. But that's, you know, who knows what the truth is? It's hard to find out. So it's kind of like, what is this thing? I can't really figure out what I think about it, because I go through my optimistic phases where I listen to people like Jeff Booth talk about it. Guy Swan has his whole AI Unchained like side podcast that he did, which is super interesting. It talks about how, you know, this will make our lives so much easier. It'll get rid of the mundane jobs that should be removed, so humans will have more space and energy to focus on these bigger ideas. And then, of course, there's a dark side. You know, just, are we going toward Terminator land? And all this bad stuff. So where are you at in terms of, like, if the neutral needle is down the middle, where are you in terms of optimistic versus pessimistic for how this will affect our future, and maybe how will Bitcoin give us a better chance to push that needle in a positive direction?
Yeah, so that was one of the classic college essay questions is, like, what is some fear you have or something of that nature? And so I was reading about superintelligence and basically this idea that all of machines will surpass the capabilities of humans. And I was like, oh no, there's no seatbelt on this. And so that got me into the kind of the ethics and AI piece of it. I think economic incentive changes a lot with how this will play out, but I'm just choosing to remain more optimistic on this rather than pessimistic on it. I'm taking another class this semester, Law, Policy, and Politics of AI, so I hope I will get a lot smarter over the coming 14 weeks. But yeah, I just think it's just generally how I try to live life or think about life is just on the more positive side of things, with still keeping in mind what's the negative so you can plan and think about it, but not try to live each day but, oh, I'm so worried about this, I'm concerned about that. I think that's okay, good, great, I'm worried about something, but how can I take action to, you know, fix that or alleviate that concern rather than just stew on something for the sake of stewing on it.
I couldn't agree more. I think that I love how you put it, just choose to be optimistic. You know, it sounds overly simplified, but I think that once you have your mindset really dialed in, I'm the exact same way. I just, you know, I dive into all these different rabbit holes. I'm not sure how much you float outside of Bitcoin trying to learn all these different crazy things that Bitcoiners talk about, conspiracy theories and whatnot that turn out to be true. there's a lot of dark stuff out there. There's a lot of dark, dark things to look at. Into which, interestingly, very often ties back to the fiat system. Mm-hmm. And so I can choose, and we all can choose, are we going to be consumed by all this darkness that's everywhere, or are we going to use that as a motivation to better take that optimistic approach and be more powerful in being able to push that forward and make sure that optimistic future is what happens and manifest it altogether. Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's so important. And how do you see that for Gen Z? We talked about this earlier, how a lot of Gen Z has a really pessimistic view for the future, which is, you know, bad. We need to change that. So how do we connect these two things? A generation which is currently on a pessimistic side, get them into that mindset where they see hope for the future. And I'm sure, you know, we've talked about Bitcoin and Ostra, how they will help foster that for them. How do you think we get there? What happens between A and B to where we need to get to? Because I think we can all agree we need to have an optimistic young generation. If you don't have an optimistic, you know, incoming generation, it's tough to build a better future.
Yeah. I think defining fears, defining what you're scared about, pessimistic about, is really helpful. Sometimes, like, I don't know if you've ever done, like, the Tim Ferriss fear chart or any one of those, just really. So basically, it's three columns, and it's like, okay, I'm going to define what is the worst thing that could happen? What am I scared about? It's what am I scared about? And then let's say this happens, what is the worst thing that could come from that? And then what am I going to do to fix it? I think that's generally correct how it works. You know, I think also Natalie Brunell does a really good job about this, well, in all things, but when she's talking, you know, on CNBC or something, defining, you know, what is the problem we're really talking about, inflation, that the money is broken, really making that connection for people, I think, is helpful. For younger generations, as you were mentioning, yes, most of them, like, loneliness is off the chart for younger generations. They don't want to maybe have a family. Actually, the number one concern or fear in a report that I read was the economy and not being able, like, they don't want to set up long-term goals because they just don't think it's achievable. Just in such a short-term, high-time preference mindset. And most people have no idea what I'm talking about when I talk about time preference. So I can say it here, but I don't often say it elsewhere. And, you know, so I think just really validating that, you know, yes, what you're feeling is, you know, truthful and valid, and let's talk about it and try to define it and really get to what the problem is. And then we can really start to understand how Bitcoin, how Nostr can work into as a solution. I guess a rabbit hole I'm trying to learn more about. Obi, the founder of Fedi, described an acronym BLEND, like Bitcoin, Lightning, eCash, Nostr, and then decentralized tech as a stack. How can BLEND be a solution and help us? And starting there and really kind of letting the conversation take its course. But a lot stems from the problem with money is just so broken, and try to get people, as I was speaking about earlier, get to some solid foundation so that then we can try to have the best positioning to build a solid and a sound life. I think it certainly doesn't mean you fix the money and you're never going to face another challenge. You know, I think challenges in life are good. You learn things from that. But at least you could just, you know, kind of run the race and not just perpetually get behind the starting line, because you feel like you can't keep up.
Yeah, I've never heard of that Tim Ferriss chart you talked about, but I think that even to simplify it even more, just saying, you know, what's the worst that can happen from this thing you're scared of? And I think we could agree that most of the time you can come up with, oh, like we die or something like that. Well, we're going to die anyway. So yeah. Why are you letting that fear dictate your actions? You know, mm-hmm. why don't you just start there? You know, you're going to die anyway. So stop using that as fear and think about how you can just create something awesome that can help make sure that we just turn the ship around in a better direction. I think that's a good way to think of it for sure. And just, there's so many of these different tricks for just mental health. And
yeah.
Another thing that's worth mentioning is that and this is a whole different conversation, whether it's kind of a chicken or the egg problem about this pessimistic for the pessimism for the future that Gen Z has on average. And also mental health is terrible for Gen Z. This is like the most mentally unwell. So many kids being just put on antidepressants and being lonely. Like you said, it seems like brains are really closing down in a way. What are the things that you think could help people on the mental side? And this could be totally separate from Bitcoin, just like a completely, you know, off-topic question if we want it to be. But I think this is important for this audience to hear. And, you know, something I talk about a ton on this podcast is the carnivore diet. I think that's a huge thing. I'm sure you've heard about it from all the Bitcoiners posting pictures of steak everywhere. But for me, that helped me just like literally refuel my brain to the point where I'm just able to think about things more. I have more energy. I sleep better. Everything just kind of helps from the nutrition side. But what other things have you found? Because you're clearly like a high-powered young brain. So what are your tricks to the other folks in your age group that could help them out?
Yeah, no, thank you. And I also just maybe just one more comment on the previous question. I try to give a lot of grace to younger generations and my peers because, you know, just my experience in college, you basically arrive as a freshman and I think most people already feel behind.
Same.
You don't even get this time to truly think about what do I want to study or what do I want to do. It's okay, you know, I just got into this school, but now I need to get into this club so that then I can get this alumni network, so then I can get this job. And like my sophomore year, I was recruiting for internships for that summer and my after junior year summer. So you're kind of like double recruiting for jobs. And so there is just so much coming at you, and there's the social aspect and you're just normal coursework and everything else in life that it's not, you know, it's not just like, oh, you know, just take more time to think and figure out your fears. Like there's a lot else at play. And I also think, you know, apathy is probably worse than pessimism or optimism, because feeling that emotion, you know, you're invested, you care, you're thinking about this. But going back to your other question on some strategies. So I was going to say food. I think food makes a big impact on how you function. Also community, I think, is hugely important. And the reason I say that is because my freshman year of college was 2021, 2022, right after COVID, couldn't go to China because at that time there was Delta and then the Omicron variants. And so I started at NYU, New York, because we couldn't get to Shanghai. I lasted a month in New York City with five roommates, and my classes at 1 a.m. didn't totally work out for me. I'm a huge introvert. And so I just said, hey, can I just take my online classes instead of online at school, online at home? And so I lived by myself for a year. And the first month, or maybe 2 months, up until it was Halloween, I didn't really notice it, but I really didn't feel like myself. And then it was Halloween, and I ordered a bag of candy and put out a candy bucket, and I was so happy that day. And actually no one came because my street apparently was really dark and there were no trick-or-treaters. But I was like, oh, I actually got to think about something other than myself and my own needs and just me. I was like focused on someone else. And so, where I was living, I couldn't even take out my neighbor's trash or hold the door open for someone. Or I went to a boarding school, so I couldn't, make my roommate lunch, or just couldn't do anything for anybody else. And so for me, I think community is a big part, and just being a community member and, trying to see other people succeed and be their cheerleader. So then after that, I changed. I was like, okay, Ella, you gotta fix this and, kind of build more community into your life. But that's another big one.
I love that. I think that's so true. The community side is so crucial. There's just infinite studies in history to show us that when people are in a really strong network of like-minded individuals, we find our tribe. We can just ascend so much better. We have a support system there for us. People aren't meant to be alone. We are social beings. And this takes different forms depending on your environment. So I'm here at my alma mater right now, and I went to this old bar to go get some hamburger patties for dinner last night. And there was a basketball game happening, and there were far fewer people there than I swear there would have been when I was there. This was 2017 when I graduated, and it's now 8 years later. So quite a few things have happened in the last 8 years, and the bar was pretty empty. And I was like, man, that's kind of saying, it kind of tells me the community side is weakening a little bit. People are less coming together to, and of course it's like fiat sports ball, whatever. This isn't the most significant thing, but that's like a college thing, So it's another one of those chicken or the egg things. Is this happening because people are so stressed out more and more about needing to, work harder to get that higher paying job that they know they'll need because their parents had a terrible financial experience. They feel this weight on their shoulders, or is it the other way around? Tough to say, but it's really important. And this sort of takes me into a question I was going to ask earlier before we got moving in a different direction, but your community that you're creating through these clubs, I think that that's a great example of one that could really blossom into something that changes so many lives for the better and creates this community for people. But what I'm curious to ask you here is, how high are your ambitions for this? When you see the future, do you think that this could potentially grow to the point, and we're dreaming here, of course, you can, be ambitious. Do you think that this could end up changing the way that the schools actually create their curriculums? Because like we mentioned earlier, these Bitcoin clubs are going to be at odds with the current economics classes. Or is the idea more that you're going to empower all the individuals so they don't even need to, it basically frees them without caring about what the classes are in the school itself.
Yeah. And I would say the clubs are never really meant to be at odds. Just, hey, did you know there's a different theory of thought called Austrian economics? It's not all Keynesian. A lot of people just didn't know that there's a whole other theories of economics out there. When I got to Cornell, I'm in the Arts and Sciences College here, and I came in thinking I was going to study computer science and China and Asia Pacific studies. And then I saw that they had started an independent major program and a cognitive science major. And cognitive science was really what I was after when I was applying to schools, but it had only been a minor. And then the year I was transferring, it became a major. So I switched over to that. And I also went through the process of an independent major on Bitcoin. And it took 15 months. Ultimately, I got it approved in a different program that I'm in now called the Robert S. Harrison College Scholar Program. But I think ideally, a study of Bitcoin can't exist just in one school or one class or kind of one college. Probably how it's structured is that it just sits above, or there's like a different perspective that you look at it in the engineering, in arts and sciences, in human ecology and tech policy. Because as we've talked about, it's just so interdisciplinary and sends you down so many different paths. And so, yeah, it's not so much, I don't think, it's like integrating it from above rather than below. And so why this group started is, you know, I went through this experience of just 15 months of trying to learn about Bitcoin, think about it. And rather than go from kind of the top down, the students network is more of a bottom up. You know, let's just try to help the students create the space to have these conversations. It's a lot of work to start a club and to figure out how to run it. And so I kind of realized that as I was going through it myself and making it myself. And so I just thought, and with my co-founder, Arsh Malu, you know, let's just try to break down any barriers to other students starting this. Let's just, you know, build a guide on how to do literally everything, put all the templates in there and try to make it easier. So, you know, And I think education's probably going to change a lot as well over the years. I'm not sure if we'll ever see a official Bitcoin degree or what that looks like. But what I would probably more so hope, it's let's just give more kind of sound academics. Like, let's just engage with topics really truthfully and evaluate all perspectives and sides. And, you know, let's really put energy into thinking about this. Let's embrace more of like a proof of work mentality. You have to go to the library and study for a test. It's, you don't graduate because, you know, your friend tells the dean that they saw you studying. There's no staking what you've done on someone else. And so rather, I just hope we take some of these values about integrity, honesty, transparency, and put that in academia, because there's a lot of really hard problems out there in the world that we need to solve. And so I think that's probably my greater wish there. But the Students Network, we're in a lot of different universities around the world, and really just, so layer zero, I don't know who officially coined this term, but the idea of like the social community layer of a network, really building that and talking about the features of Bitcoin and, you know, why it matters that it's decentralized, that it's scarce. I think it's important to share those features. We also just launched a new internship program called Layer Zero, and it is really going to help put students in Bitcoin communities around the world this summer, all expenses paid. And you just go learn and see Bitcoin on the ground. And there's two people that I think really impacted me in thinking about this. So Natalie Smolinski, last year at the Bitcoin Policy Institute Summit, I would recommend everyone go watch her talk. But she, one of the pieces kind of she opened in it with was the importance of your peer-to-peer network and just how community, this network that you have, the actual physical peer, is so important. And so really helping young people build this work experience, build this peer-to-peer network, you know, come to the physical, not just in the digital. And then Alex Thorne on the Unchained Foundations podcast, I think Joe asked him, you know, what's a big concern or fear that you have? And it was something along the lines of, you know, younger, new people coming in, not understanding the features and why Bitcoin is the way it is. And so it's another piece in the club. It's like, really talking about Bitcoin and the decisions that were made.
Yeah, well, it may be a slow grind of getting people interested in this, or showing them why they should be interested in it, and growing those numbers, growing the community, and growing that social network, as you talked about, one thing we have going for us is that we know that once you become a Bitcoiner, there's no going back. you don't reverse out of Bitcoin once you truly take the dive and do the proof of work and research and realize what this thing is. So you can't underestimate that when every single person that grows, even if it's slow, as it grows more and more and more, those people stick with it. They have extreme staying power. So it's really exciting to think about that. And I'd also love to, just while we're on the topic of the social side and the networking side, I know that you've been featured at multiple conferences at this point. You have been, you know, put out on stage as, you know, a great representative for Gen Z, which, I mean, you can tell why by listening. You're killing it on this stuff, which is excellent. What has your experience been at these conferences? How have people taken you in? And give us just like a summary of your experience doing that.
Oh my gosh, it's been the biggest gift, and I'm incredibly just beyond grateful to have been able to be at all of these places, and just how warm and welcoming it's been. So I got to go to Bitcoin Prague. That was my first conference, actually my first ever Bitcoin thing, I think, was the Houston Bitcoin Meetup. So I always say,
What year was that?
Oh gosh.
For timeline?
Maybe 2020.
Okay.
I think.
So about five years ago now.
21.
Yeah.
So one of those. So I think going in person to just meeting other people is huge. But then I went to Bitcoin Prague, and it was there, Farida Naparema, who organizes the Africa Bitcoin Conference, I got to ride with her in an Uber and Anita Posh to the airport, leaving the hotel. And we just had a conversation. And then, I don't know, it wasn't a week later, and Farida had invited me to come to the Africa Bitcoin Conference. And so people just, I mean, I hadn't done anything. I wasn't, she had no reason to be so kind and generous, but she was. And that I could just tell that story about so many different people in this space, just incredibly generous with their knowledge and their time and their support. I'm like, someone pinched me. I'm hugely, hugely lucky.
And there are a lot of opportunities, even if you don't, you know, strike gold and meet any of these awesome people that you just mentioned, because mm-hmm. those are pretty well-known figures in the space at this point. Just the average person out there is just starting to learn about Bitcoin for the first time. You don't really know the community yet. You don't know the network, but you want to go get yourself involved somehow. I know that there are really cool opportunities out there. Like in this, the most recent Bitcoin conference in Nashville had this student pass program where a bunch of people could actually come for free. So I'm sure you followed that. How did that exactly work?
Yeah, so we partnered with Bitcoin Magazine to offer a student pass, and we brought about 1,500 students there that claimed it, and we did a side student event meetup. Maybe like 300 students came, and it'll be back for 2025, maybe some other things. I think it's really great to be able to bring students into these spaces. Well, students of all ages, you know, there's many, not just university age students in. I think it's been my experience that, you know, Bitcoiners want to see you succeed, want to wish you well. And so sometimes you just got to be the first person to, you know, ask or reach out to someone. And also, you know, do some work yourself. I think but people want to see you win and succeed.
Yeah, and needless to say, I mean, both of us, I'm sure, would agree that we highly recommend all the young folks out there look into this, get on this. Even if there aren't those sorts of perks like the free passes, I mean, check for that, of course, because a lot of conferences do want to see these young people. They really want to help young people get in. But even if not, it may be worth something, or it may be something worth saving up for if you can't do that. Because there's so much value in this. And maybe you could like elaborate just like, what is the value that, you know, just some person studying in a classroom or hearing about this and like, oh, maybe I should just go to this totally different Bitcoin thing to try it out.
I mean, I will say you can watch everything online. I think what you really get out of it is just the spontaneous, you know, the spontaneity of what's going to happen, who you might bump into, who you might meet. I mentioned Arsh earlier. I met him because he was on a Twitter space that my mom was on. And then I just reached out and sent a DM, and he's been hugely impactful in my Bitcoin journey and what I've been able to do. So also, you know, Twitter spaces are great. You know, just reaching out to someone over Twitter or email or whatever platform it is can be great. But I think you go to one of these conferences to meet people, talk to people, be curious about what they're doing, what they're building. That's what I've always gotten the most out of, I think, from it. You kind of just get the energy of the space. When I walked up to Bitcoin Park in Nashville for the first time, have you been to Bitcoin Park? Yeah. So
that's the first Bitcoin thing I did when I got there, actually. It was like, yeah. I think my plane landed and it right as I was landing, the thing was starting. So I had to rush my stuff to my Airbnb and get over there, but I got to see it and it was super cool. Great little campus.
So I'd say, like, I don't know, the same thing for like PubKey in New York City. You just go, and I can't really describe it, but there's something about just the energy and just like the brain cells that are in that place. You learn so much. Side note, I feel like every day I'm in Bitcoin, I know less, which I take to be a gift. So yeah, I think that's huge. Also, for any students listening, I mean, reach out to me. I had 4 calls today with students. Like, one was in Malawi, Nigeria, all over the place. Like, I love being able to talk to people. So I'm more than happy to set up time to talk and meet someone, you know, on a Google Meet or whatever it might be.
Amazing. I think that's a great way to sort of wrap this up, is that I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who are wondering, you know, what next? And we've thrown out some good ideas. Look for a Bitcoin club at your school. If there isn't one, start one. Look for conferences that are happening, meetups in your city, all the stuff you can find online, and even reach out to you. So what do you think are, I mean, what would you say is like the best next steps, is your summary?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just take a step, figure out, you know, what is it that you're really interested in right now, just in your life, and then try to think about, okay, what's one way it tangents over to Bitcoin. You know, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot to learn in this space. And I don't, you know, stress yourself out that, oh, I've got to know how transactions work and Austrian economics and all this stuff all at once. You just start learning. You know, you can put a podcast on when you're doing the dishes or whatever it might be. Just start. And then I have a notes app on my phone. It's like things to learn about, just questions I have. And so start jotting down questions you have and kind of see where it takes you. Some people might be more of like a podcast or a book type of person. I think, you know, maybe you start there. You just read a book. If you're a student, academic, Resistance Money, which came out last year, I think is a really good book because it doesn't presume that you are a Bitcoiner or you think Bitcoin is good. Actually, the first line is Bitcoin is for criminals. And it just, you know, provides a very unbiased, do you want to live in a world with Bitcoin or without Bitcoin? So perhaps that's a good place to start if you're kind of a little on the fence, you're not sure. And then make a peer. You know, what I really like is that network is mentioned 21 times in the white paper. Bitcoin is mentioned twice. And, you know, a network, all it is just 2 nodes. So, you know, Ben, you and I are each one. And now technically we're a network because there are 2 of us here. Just go find one person to talk about with. Ask someone if you can take them to coffee or, I think any of those are a good first step, just one step after another.
I love it. What are all the links you would spread out there? We're going to have a nice, fun, full show notes here because we gave out a lot of different cool resources for people. What would be the ones that you would recommend, and how can people find you and your projects?
Yeah, so I can give you one link for me. It's just like Linktree / my name, and it links out to the Students Network and, you know, resources and talks and whatnot. But we can also link in maybe like the Layer Zero internship application for students, which is probably the next best.
Amazing. And follow you on Nostra as well. I'm going to put your end pub in there. That, I will always shill that as much as I can.
Yes, and I have it. So I somehow I have the primal.net slash my handle. So that's on the link tree as well. But yeah, definitely Nostra.
So many ways to connect. So many things to learn about for all the people out there. I hope that everyone listening, whether you are a student or even a parent that has a student or someone's just curious about the next generation, I hope you all got some value out of this. I know that I did. Ella Huff, it has been absolutely wonderful talking to you today. Thank you so much for coming by and continue doing amazing big things for the world and making us inspired for the future. You're doing great. Love to watch.
Thank you. No, thank you, Ben, for, you know, just all that you do and all that. It's not easy to have a podcast and record these shows. So thank you so much for doing it.